Here's a little of the climax of one of this summer's biggest hits, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Harry and Lord Voldemort come face to face at last.
Harry Potter. The boy who lived. Come to die.
Audiences around the world lined up to see if the boy who lived would indeed die, and many felt bereft themselves that the beloved series was coming to a close, almost like they were losing real friends. Why do we get so wrapped up in imaginary worlds, either our own with daydreaming or others, as when we see a Harry Potter film? Well, Yale psychologist Paul Bloom says that when we get involved in activities of imagination, we aren't just wasting time, that activities in fantasy worlds make up our favorite leisure time activity more than eating or playing or sex. Paul Bloom explores the power of the daydream and other works of the imagination as part of his book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. It's just been released in paperback. We spoke last year and started by asking Paul Bloom just what he meant by saying we spend all this time in imaginary worlds, our own and others.
Think about it. I mean, if you ask people what they like to do the most, they'll often answer sex or socializing, being with their kids. But if you actually look at the amount of hours they spend each day on different pleasures, the imagination wins easily. There's television, there's movies, there's books. And when we're by ourselves, we often daydream. We create fantasy worlds and we enjoy them. So at least looking at it from the standpoint of time spent, imaginative pleasures are easily at the top of the list. Stories and fantasy and game playing and gossip, but also strictly imaginative activity of telling people about events that don't exist are a huge occupation.
Sure.
Of people around the world.
Sure. Did you hear what happened on The Office last night? Wait a minute. The Office isn't real.
That's right. And I think people often end up caring more about characters that aren't real than characters that are real. People weep over the death of characters in Harry Potter. They obsess over the adventures of people on The Office. And this is just a fascinating fact about human nature.
As you quote one psychologist saying, why do we get so emotionally involved in the lives of fake characters? Why do we?
To some extent, we're oblivious to the difference between reality and things that are not real. So you could really enjoy listening to a couple of people talk and say humorous things, and you could really enjoy watching this happen on TV when you know that this is all scripted. We could become aroused at seeing certain naked people and sexual activities, and you could be equally aroused watching these things on a computer laptop. You could be disgusted at a certain disgusting sight, and then equally disgusted at seeing it in a magazine. To some extent, we don't care. Our minds are insensitive difference between real and imagined. And that's in part because a lot of our experience is brought to us through our senses. And our senses don't make a big difference between something we really see and something we see on television, our movies, or even that which in which we imagine.
Which is why we cry over the death of characters in Dickens, or J.K. Rowling gets letters, people begging her to spare their favorite character in Harry Potter.
She got letters saying, please don't kill Harry, please don't kill Hermione. As if these are real people and somebody is pleading to a kidnapper or a god to protect them.
Some other of your findings. Several studies show reading a fact in a story, even if the story's fiction, increases the likelihood that you believe the fact to be true. And you say, well, sure, we actually do learn a lot of facts in fiction.
That's right. It would be the wrong conclusion to draw to say, look how stupid people are. They learn things from movies. They learn things from fictional books. Because in order to tell a story, you have to include a lot of things that are true. So I've actually never been on death row. But I have a sense of what death row is like. I've never been in a submarine. I've never been in 18th century Russia. But I have a sense what all of these things are like because I've experienced them in fiction. And I could trust a fiction writer and a movie maker is savvy enough to be more or less accurate in how these things are depicted.
It's interesting. It's all virtual because it's in all likelihood passed from their imagination to yours.
That's right. And I don't want to overstate how useful it is because sometimes you could be really led astray. The Da Vinci Code is a classic example of this, where the writer and then later the filmmakers established a world of facts where the facts are actually not true.
Right.
But people read the book, they see the movie, and then they absorb the facts as if they were true. And I think that such facts would stick a lot deeper than facts if they just simply read a newspaper article or a textbook.
But on the other hand, just staying with your first thought about just being able to get an impression of something, I remember asking Stephen Bochco, who created L.A. Mm-hmm. Law and Hill Street Blues and all these terrific shows, and I'd say, Hill Street Blues. I mean, the police would say, that is, he's got it down. And so I said to him, you know, did you go out on the beat, and how long did you spend in the station? He'd say, I never left my armchair. He never went once, never looked. So we can...
And in this world, there's often a cycle where somebody does an imagined product like Hill Street Blues based on their impression of what it's like to be a cop.
Yeah.
And then future cops go and they look back on the show and they reference it. The Godfather and the movie Goodfellas are classic examples where presumably mobsters would later style themselves after these mob characters that were thought up by creative people.
So that's the imagination creating reality.
Exactly.
Do animals have imagination?
Animals, non-human animals, say chimpanzees or say dogs, they often do something which is, I think, interestingly related to the human imagination, in that they play. On the other hand, the flexibility we see with human play, with human pretense to human imagination, I think has no parallels in the animal world.
And again, just if you could put it in a nutshell, why is that so good for us? Because, you know, we've been told it's wasting time. We're supposed to be feverishly working for our survival and the betterment of society.
The big question is, what's this for? What is this imaginary capacity for? And I want to be cautious here. A lot of the everyday use of the imagination isn't for anything. It's that we have this capacity, this mental capacity. We get pleasure from it. And so we seek out these pleasures.
I was just going to say that, gosh, I'm wondering if early on, if you stood around just daydreaming or imagining things, you'd get eaten by a dinosaur.
That's right. You'd imagine an animal that spent its time seeking out mates and setting up shelter and capturing food would do a lot better than an animal who spent his time lying on his back imagining better things and fantasizing about what the good life would be. But on the other hand, the reason why we have this imagination in the first place is for an extremely powerful and I think very adaptive use, which is to imagine worlds that don't exist gives you a very special power. It lets you plan for the future, in that you could imagine alternative worlds, explore what they would be like, and then choose accordingly. It lets you practice. So to some extent, instead of me, I don't know, having a discussion with my friend or making a big sales pitch or trying to seduce somebody in the real world, just having to do it once, I could do it 100 times in my head before doing it for real. And this sort of mental practice, which is something that athletes know about and any performer knows about, doing it in your head ahead of time, practicing ahead of time, is, I think, a gift that allows us to respond far more adaptively and far better in the real world.
That's Paul Bloom. His new book is How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. We've been talking about two chapters in particular on imagination. Professor Bloom, Paul, thanks so much. Fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dream when I want you in my arms, when I want you, and all your charms whenever I want you. All I have to do is dream. I can make you mine, taste your lips of wine anytime, night or day. Only trouble is, gee whiz, I'm dreaming my life away. I need you so that I could die. I love you so, and that is why whenever I want you, all I have to do, taste your lips of wine anytime, night or day. Only trouble is, gee whiz, I'm dreaming.